Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments in the world of infectious disease. And boy, it's a good time to be in infectious disease. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
Shortly after we got off the air last week, when we sounded a maybe it's not so bad note about what had appeared to be an aborted effort to change the childhood vaccination schedule, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s Department of Health and Human Services rolled out big changes to the recommended childhood vaccination schedule. Vaccines for rotavirus, COVID-19, influenza, hepatitis A, hepatitis B, and meningitis are now no longer recommended for every child. They are just what's called shared clinical decision-making vaccines, meaning they're available, get them if you want to. Also, the vaccine for RSV is only being recommended now for high-risk groups or populations. I thought we could start today by kind of walking through the implications, and since everyone who cares about their child's health is going to have to become an infectious disease expert themselves, apparently, walk through what some of these vaccines do. We had talked previously about the implication of phasing out the recommendation that newborns get hepatitis B to head off any transmission from their birthing parent. What about rotavirus? What do we know about how useful the vaccine has been?
The rotavirus vaccine protects people who get it from a really bad diarrhea, often associated with vomiting as well. And it's pretty miserable. The particular problem with rotavirus is not in otherwise healthy, older children and healthy adults. But where we really see its profound effect is on little kids. They don't have large bodies. They don't have large volumes of fluid in their bodies. And a rotaviral infection can throw them into dehydration very quickly. And that precipitates hospitalization. And without hospitalization and proper medical therapy, it can result in death. And it has resulted in lots of deaths and lots of hospitalizations in young children. And because of that, there was a large effort years ago to develop a rotavirus vaccine. And fortunately, we did develop one, and it works really well, and it's very safe. And it has dramatically reduced the number of hospitalizations in the United States from rotaviral disease, dramatically, from up averaging maybe 70,000 hospitalizations in pediatric patients a year before the vaccine to a fraction of that now. It's a very valuable vaccine.
How much of the protection kids get from it comes from the effects of the vaccine itself versus from the herd immunity, the population effect of having a vaccination program?
Well, certainly if you prevent rotaviral disease in one child, that child is not going to be shedding the virus, which is highly contagious, and therefore it protects other children. So you do get herd immunity. And that's one of the arguments for continuing this vaccine. And the American Academy of Pediatrics strongly recommends continuing this vaccine for all children.
I was somewhat stunned to see the meningococcal vaccine make the list. This is for a form of, as I understand it, viral meningitis, brain swelling. I went to high school with a kid who, basically started vomiting in his dorm shortly after he left for college and went into a coma and died from an abrupt onset case of acute meningitis. This is like a serious disease.
It's a real serious disease. It's a vaccine that protects against a particular bacterium called Neisseria meningitidis. Often we call it the meningococcus or meningococcal meningitis. This bacteria, fortunately, is not common, but when it occurs, the results are devastating. And it typically occurs, it can occur at any age, from very young to very old and everything in between. But it classically occurs in otherwise healthy teenagers, particularly kids who go off to college and get exposed to the bacterium, and they can come down with meningococcal meningitis. Even with treatment, the bacterium is susceptible to most of our antibiotics, but even with appropriate early treatment, 10 to 15% of the cases are fatal. 20 to 60% of the cases experience permanent disability. I've seen too many cases of this, and it can result in just absolute tragedies. So the vaccine against this bacterium is highly effective. It protects against 70 to 90% of the cases. The benefits greatly outweigh the risks. It's still highly recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics.
Thank you for politely correcting the fact that I mistakenly referred to it as a virus before. What is, in anti-vaccine circles, what is the rationale for making meningococcal vaccine, the vaccine that prevents this form of meningitis, a matter of shared clinical decision-making rather than something that's just recommended for every child?
Well, the rationale for it is that this bacteria doesn't occur often. When it does occur, bacterial disease does not occur often. When it does occur, I mentioned how devastating it is, but it also can be spread from one person to another. A number of years ago in Oakland, there was a patient who was found unconscious outdoors, brought into the emergency room by medics. The patient turned out to have meningococcal disease. Tragically, the patient died. Two of the medics who brought the patient in the ambulance came down with meningococcal disease. So the rationale for this is certainly to protect somebody's own health, but it can help. If that person doesn't develop meningococcal disease, it's much less likely the person's going to spread it. The nuanced issue here is that this is not common. Meningococcal disease is not common. And when one looks at the cost effectiveness, just based upon dollars, you can argue both ways. When one looks at the cost effectiveness in terms of the risks versus the benefits, it's a no-brainer in terms of the benefits of the vaccine. So herd immunity, if everybody got the meningococcal vaccine, might not make too much of a difference. It's unclear. But clearly, if you want to protect your child from this disease, this is a very valuable vaccine.
We've discussed them at length before, but probably worth briefly rehashing. Making vaccination for COVID and influenza, the two big seasonal diseases, matters of shared clinical decision-making for children. How big a public health impact does that have?
Oh, enormous. Somehow, the American public believes that COVID is no big deal for children. And it has been a big deal for children. It's killed an awful lot of children. It doesn't spare children. Fortunately, children seem to have less morbidity and mortality from it than older adults, but it still kills children and still hospitalizes children. Influenza is a very serious disease, particularly in very young children and in older people. It's a miserable disease for anybody who gets it, but the very young and the very old are the ones that suffer the most from it. We've already had this year 17 deaths in the United States from influenza. Over 80% of those deaths occurred in children who are not immunized. I want to repeat that. We've had 17 deaths so far from influenza, and 80% of those children were not immunized. So the vaccine, while not nearly as good as we'd like, does help protect against hospitalization and death. And this is a terribly important issue for children. So COVID, influenza vaccines, mom and dad, please protect your children with these vaccines.
Just wanted to clarify, it is 17 confirmed pediatric deaths from influenza.
Yes, yes, thank you. Pediatric
deaths. Unfortunately, of a much larger number.
Right.
Sorry, go ahead, Dr. Swartzberg.
No, a much larger number in adults. That's right. Last year, we had in the influenza season almost 300 pediatric deaths from influenza, 90%. Of the children who died from flu weren't vaccinated.
We should open the phone lines for questions right now. 1-800-958-9008. That's 1-800-958-9008 to put a question to Dr. Swartzberg. He is clinical professor emeritus of infectious diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. 1-800-958-9008 for your corona calls. And the first question we have from our inbox, Dr. Swartzberg, is on the topic of flu. Wendy in Santa Rosa wrote in to ask if getting the flu provides any level of immunity or resistance in the way getting COVID does for reducing the severity of COVID. Maybe we can turn that into a compare and contrast. How does the immunity from getting infected with one compare to the immunity from getting infected with the other?
Pretty similar between the two. I think this is an opportunity to talk about what vaccines do. Vaccines present your body with a piece of the virus or bacterium, and your body develops an immune response to that, and you're protected the next time your body sees the real virus or the real bacterium. It doesn't do anything differently than getting the real virus and the real bacterium. So you get good immunity from getting the flu and getting COVID, but you pay the price of getting sick. And sometimes that sickness can be really severe. So what vaccines are really doing is they're essentially tricking your body's immune system in the sense that it's telling your body you've been exposed to this bacteria or virus. So when you really get exposed to it, you don't get it. When it comes to COVID, we know that the immunity from infection is very similar to the immunity from vaccine. And disappointingly, the immunity from both is not permanent and it wanes fairly quickly. So after roughly 6 months, you've lost a considerable amount of protection either from COVID or the vaccine, with no appreciable difference between the two. With influenza, the story is pretty much the same. So if you had flu 1 year, you'll be protected for getting it for a number of months, but you're not protected very well after that. Now, there is some residual protection from either the vaccine or flu and COVID, the disease flu and COVID, that can last a long, long time because of our ability of our immune system to remember. So we do get some long-term protection, but it's nothing like what we really need to protect us.
There are slight differences between the immunity we get from the vaccine and the disease, right? I mean, like in the case of COVID, what the vaccine, the mRNA vaccines, are showing to your immune system is just a part of the virus, just the spike protein.
Right. And the vaccine we have for influenza is part of that virus, what's called the hemagglutinin and the neuraminidase antigens on the surface. And that's that's the way almost all of our vaccines work. Those are the parts of the virus that are key for the virus to infect us and continue to replicate in us. So we don't need to give the whole virus or the whole bacterium to create that similar immunity.
All right, let's go to the phone lines. Again, it's 1-800-958-9008 to put a question to Dr. John Swartzberg. First up, we have from the Central Valley, John in Fresno. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Happy New Year to you guys. Doctor, I've tried to ask this question before. So this sort of internet stuff. Is there some kind of risk of heart damage from the COVID vaccines? I've taken your advice and my doctor's advice and gotten them and gotten boosters, and I'm happy that I'm managing my risks. But when this comes up in conversation, they say, oh, don't get a vaccination because it's going to damage your heart. What is the medical opinion on that?
Sure. Thanks, John. It's good to hear your voice again. What you're talking about is the medical problem is called myocarditis. Myo meaning the muscle of the heart, myo meaning muscle, and carditis meaning of the heart. So the vaccine can cause myocarditis, particularly in young males, teenagers in their 20s, spilling over in the 30s. It can occur in anybody, but particularly in those groups. It's not common. It's very uncommon to happen. And it tends to be very mild, not leading to it. There's not been any evidence of permanent consequences from that. Contrast that with the myocarditis that you can get from COVID. It's much, much, much more common to occur after COVID than it is after the vaccine. And the myocarditis one gets from COVID is much more severe and can lead to more permanent consequences. So that's the big issue. A lot's been made of this by the anti-vax community, including Kennedy. And they misquote what science has told us about the data, or science has given us with the data. What I've told you now is what we understand in terms of myocarditis from the vaccine versus myocarditis from COVID, with the risk-benefit ratio strongly favoring continuing to get the vaccine.
It is the rare case, Dr. Swartzberg, of a side effect of the vaccine that seems to be more prevalent in younger, healthier people. Do we understand the mechanism for that?
No. We don't. It's not clear why it's males and not much more common in young men than young women. The mechanism the best evidence we have to date is that the mechanism appears to be what we frame under the idea of autoimmune, meaning that our body reacts to the vaccine, and in a small percentage of people, that reaction to the vaccine cross-reacts with the muscle of the heart and can cause inflammation. That's the working hypothesis for this. And most of the data we have is consistent with that.
Which is also a mechanism in serious cases of COVID as well, right? Autoimmunity?
That's a leading hypothesis for the mechanism with COVID as well. But why COVID causes much more severe myocarditis and much more commonly causes myocarditis than the vaccine is unclear.
All right. Let's go to our next caller at 1-800-958-9008. Aid, you're in Berkeley. What's your question?
Oh, good morning. Yeah, before asking my question, I just like to mention one big fact. That anti-vaccine thing by Robert F. Kennedy and the whole administration is totally despicable. It's going to kill a lot of people. I'd like to remind everybody that the bubonic plague in Europe in the, 13th, 14th century killed one-third of Europeans. Over 30 to 40 million Europeans died. And once we had the vaccine, that had been something in the past that goes for other illness as well. It doesn't really make any sense. My second point, I'd like to ask the doctor, I really think that the COVID-19 have some effect on the brain, even if people did not show any symptoms. And I think that to some extent explain the whole situation we are going through today. Remember everybody, 1.3 million Americans died from COVID-19 in the year 2000, 2020 and so on, because Donald Trump called it a hoax, called it a China virus, all this thing. My question, how do we educate the public? And my main point, though, the effect of COVID-19 on the brain. I think that human brain have a lot of effect, even if it do not show any symptoms. There is some effect, and that it kind of explains the whole dark political situation we're going through right now, and the whole health thing, and the economy, and many, many other things. Thank you, and I'd like some feedback from our great doctor. Thank you.
I feel like maybe we should start with a clarification, Dr. Swartzberg. I don't think vaccines have played... There is a plague vaccine, but I don't think it's played a meaningful role in halting the spread of plague. It's not a particularly good vaccine. It's just used for really high-risk people like lab workers. My understanding is plague was controlled by vector control, figuring out it was rodents delivering fleas to people that helped spread the disease and you know, targeting it where it was spread from.
Right, you are, Brian. Yeah, the plague vaccine, while available, is not particularly useful in most, the vast amount of circumstances. And yes, we've controlled plague by understanding how plague is transmitted. The bacterium that causes plague is still in California foothills, and not just in California foothills, but spreads throughout the Southwest, all the way up.
That's right. Squirrels look cute, but they could give you the Black Death.
Well, it's particularly the rodents, but squirrels can too. Yeah. So I think the important point that you're making, Brian, is that science gives us the understanding of what the phenomena of how infectious diseases are all about, how they transmit, how they cause illness, etc. And without that kind of research, we're really pretty helpless in the natural world. And again, this is consistent with what the caller was just saying. We really need to stop this anti-science movement in the United States.
The second part of Aid's comment was that there is some evidence that any infection with COVID, even mild infections, have some impact on the brain. There was a prominent study in a British medical journal, I can't remember which one, probably because of my two cases of COVID, that suggested accelerated reduction in brain mass loss in people who had the disease. Going from that to saying there's an actual impairment in functioning is a leap in and of itself. Taking a second leap to a widespread political effect would be a leap from a leap, as I understand it. Do you have any feelings on that, Dr. Swartzberg?
On that leap from a leap? There's no question that COVID causes, is associated with brain damage. How severe that damage is, how long lasting it is, remains a question mark for the vast majority of people. It resolves. There's no question that other infectious diseases can cause the same phenomenon. Influenza is a perfect example of that, where people get a lot of the same neurological things that are seen following a COVID infection. So this is not a new phenomenon, but it appears to be more prominent with SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID, than many of the other pathogens. In terms of a leap, to suggest that the damage that might have occurred in the president's brain when he had really severe COVID has led to his behavior, I cannot opine on that.
The effects of influenza are a leading hypothesis for why Woodrow Wilson didn't do a great job negotiating the end of World War I and the post-World War order. He was very sick and impacted for a very long time. But that is a conversation for another moment. Dr. John Swartzberg, thank you for spending another Monday morning with us.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for asking me.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. We ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiegert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.